Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to director Christian A. Soderstrom about his debut feature, Video Man. We talk extensively about that film, from the origin of the picture, the casting, and how he achieved the 80s look and aesthetic of the film. Also, given the plot that centers on a yellow-obsessed video collector, we talk about the movie's many influences. And that is just the tip of the iceberg in what was an absorbing hour-long conversation that I had with Christian. A conversation I will let you get to in just a sec. But first, I want to remind you that if you enjoy the show and would like to help New Horror Express grow, we would be very grateful if you would rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. And remember, you can also check us out wherever good podcasts are available. But now, on to the interview with Christian. Hi, Christian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Nice to be here or talking to you.
It's our pleasure. So today we're going to talk to you about your debut feature, Video Man, or Video Mannen. Would that be the Swedish?
Yeah, that's a Swedish version.
Which, it debuted here at Fright Fest. It seemed to get a really good reaction. Tell us a little bit about how you came up with the story, because you're both the writer and the director. And Why you decided to make this your first feature film?
Yeah. So I as a first feature, I wanted to do something that was both not too expensive and also something that was really close to my heart. But I feel like filmmakers doing movies about movie making is kind of a cliche. But still, I felt that, I probably will need to get this out of my system anyway. So let's do this one and let's make the first one. I also had, I could see how I could make this a pretty cheap movie, money-wise. So the beginning of it was that I met a guy running a video store, late 90s actually, and I befriended this guy, and he was such a character. He was running his store like it was something very, very important, like some secret CIA thing or operation, and that was really funny to me. And so I asked him if I, after befriending him and talking to him a few years and always renting my movies there, I first started interviewing him and thought of maybe making a documentary about this guy. But then since I wanted to make a feature, I started making it. I did the interview and then I wrote a first draft. This was way back, early 2000. Then I tried to finance it and it got lost and I, for some reason, it was a tough thing to finance, and I put it in a drawer and it stayed there until 2015. And I had been doing commercial cinema for many years and I was so tired of it and I thought now is the, if I'm not going to make my first feature now, it's never going to happen. So I quit my job decided to make this one. Then I had written a few scripts by then. But this was still something that felt as a first feature, money-wise. Mm. So I picked up this project again and I kept two scenes from the first, because then it was about, okay, running a video store. So now I was asking myself the question, where would this guy be today? And that was like the starting point of writing a new video man script. And
it was just a couple of scenes you kept. It wasn't, you didn't make the film that you wrote the script for originally. You rewrote it in 2015.
Yeah, it was a totally different thing. So yes, two scenes were kept from that first old draft. And so this was a totally theme-wise a bit the same, but very different. And I'm a totally different person today than I was when I wrote that old stuff. But still, it's really got history. So it was fun that the first script I actually wrote was actually became my first feature as well.
And so you wrote the script before you directed any of your shorts?
Yeah, actually did. That's true. So,
Did you think it had difficulty getting funding? Because, I mean, it's not a straightforward horror picture, which we'll talk more about. But do you think it had difficulty getting funding because it's a horror picture? Because, like, there is kind of notable Swedish horror movies kind of throughout history from the very beginnings of horror, but there's not a lot of them.
No, that's true. I think, that's a problem. That I'm a filmmaker that I like to combine genres. I love horror, but I love every kind of genre, really. And the movies I tend to like the most are often hard to decide what genre they belong in. And so that's also something that, of course, was a problem, that I had problems with another script I'd been trying to fund years back, and they were always asking me, is this a horror movie or is it a drama? And I told them, it's both. They couldn't have that because I think it's starting to loose up. But if you only look like 10 years back, horror films in Sweden were kind of looked upon as not, good taste or something that should be financed by the state and stuff. It's been really, it's a small business here, and they're really aiming for the, I think it's kind of pretentious sometimes. I mean, everything should be only art and nothing but that, or the other way around, only like Scandinavian noir, that they call it now, police movies. So it's been tough to do things that doesn't stick to already trodden, road
just thinking about Swedish film, did anything like Let the Right One In help? Because I mean, that's like a part horror picture, part coming of age story. You can't really put it in a box, right? But it's got horror elements.
Definitely, I think that helped. Opened a few doors for people. And that's a great film in every aspect of the, it both had a horror, ran on horror festivals, and like, I don't know if it went to Cannes or whatever, but I mean, it's, everybody loves that film. And that's great, of course. That's perfect. I think the funding is, and I think I learned a lot from this film regarding that. So next time around, I'm aiming for something that could be marketed as a psychological horror film, even if it will have elements of other stuff. But I think Video Man is really hard to pinpoint that down. What is it? Is it a bit comedy? It's a bit horror. it's drama. It's it's a lot of different things, so it's a tough one to market.
I heard you in an interview saying it was like Argento meets Mike Lee, which
right, yeah,
doesn't on the surface make sense, but after you watch the movie, you're like, that does make sense.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I that's part of what I try to do to make an Argento picture with Mike Lee characters in it. I think even more the next time around. Stuff like that I love. I remember Ty West, you know, the guy who made House
of the Devil.
I love that film.
It's beautiful.
And he said something I really like, that he likes to put characters who usually doesn't belong in horror films. And that's kind of a mindset I have as well. Because I love character work and actors digging a bit deeper psychological with their characters. And I think when you combine that with a genre like horror, it's unbeatable. Movies like Don't Look Now, for instance, is one of the best ever for me. And that's because they combine horror with really, really good character work. That's something that I'm really interested in. And I think I will think a bit more commercial the next time around, even if I hate to think that way. But even if you want to make that kind of movies, I think I made it hard for me with the Video Man a bit. But I love that I've done that film, because I like it.
And it works well. And I feel like there's a lot of that kind of thinking more going on now, of like that thing that you quoted Ty West as saying about putting characters who are not you wouldn't necessarily associate with horror films in horror films. And you see more and more films like Hereditary or Raw or Get Out or any of those films that you're...
Yeah.
It's not stereotypical horror characters in a horror movie.
Right. Yeah, it's happening really fun stuff now in this genre, I think. I think also some of my biggest influences were Ben Wheatley. Mm-hmm. I think his Kill List is an amazing picture. The guy who made In Fabric now, Peter Strickland. And his Barbarian Sound Studio. Alice Lowe with Prevenge. They also loved. I think these guys are doing that in a wonderful way. Mm-hmm. So that's really what I want to achieve as well. Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously your film is, it's about all sorts of different things. It plays a lot of tribute to giallo films, but it's also a film about a kind of loneliness and being kind of locked in nostalgia. Both the kind of central characters are locked in their own nostalgia, and the kind of danger of that, of letting your kind of passions override your whole life.
Right. Exactly. That's under the surface the real thematic thread, and also it's about addiction, you know, to alcohol and nostalgia. And, you know, it's a lot about addiction to.
Because both characters are alcoholics.
Right.
Even though one of the characters doesn't really see that they're an alcoholic. I mean,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's.
I was also sorry. You go ahead.
No. I was just rambling.
that's fine. I also learned something new in the film. I didn't realize that Sweden had their own equivalent of the Video Nasties list that we had here in the UK.
That's true. We had Actually, the Swedish distributor of Videoman is called Studio S. And in the early 80s, when they released these films, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and a few Italian stuff, they had a program called Studio S, where they had a grand debate about these films and what they were doing to young people. And, you know, so that had such a big impact. So they had to draw back a few of these releases they did. And therefore, these films became so, in collectors' eyes and horror lovers' eyes, like really, you know, became the gold.
Yeah.
And it stayed that.
It had the exact same, I mean, like I'm kind of too young to properly remember it, but it had the exact same effect in the UK. And all of those, they're still sought after collector's items now, a lot of the Video Nasty lists. And I've seen quite a few of the Video Nasties, and a lot of them are, you know, would have been completely forgotten by history if they had not been on the Video Nasties list, because they're terrible.
Right.
I mean, some of them, there's some real gems in there, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I know, and that kind of comes with the package of being a hardcore collector. I think that you like stuff just because it's not always the film itself. It's everything surrounding it, like the distributor putting the movie out, or actors in it, or directors, or it's so much about something else than the film. Often, and that's both interesting and bizarre, I think.
You were saying as well that, like, you took a lot of inspiration for the central character from this video store owner you were thinking about making a documentary on, but I can only presume that you are also a big fan of a lot of the films that are featured. Obviously, the kind of central kind of MacGuffin is the missing tape of Zombie, aka right. Zombie 2, aka Zombie Flesh Eaters, whatever you want to call it. And I take it you're a big fan of those films too.
Yeah, of course. I'm a hardcore Italian exploitation movie fan, and I love all those guys: Argento, Bava, Fulci, Martino. I could go on forever, of course. So I've been growing up with a lot of those films, so they also to me are, it's a part of me. The films, a few of those films, maybe when you watch them today, you could, if you found them for the first time, I wouldn't like them so much, but they've been with me for so many years, and I think that goes for a lot of people like me who love those films. I've had them in all different kinds of outputs, like VHS, Laserdisc, DVD, Blu-ray, you know, and all. Then different Blu-ray. Been buying the same kind of film in I don't know how many versions. So it's like a lifestyle, I think. Like in those Italian things. I love Italian horror. That's
Do you prefer because the movie's about VHS, do you prefer watching some of those things on VHS? Because just in terms of some of the effects and some of the things that are kind of shown up on a clearer picture on a DVD or Blu-ray. I remember when I was a teenager, I had a VHS copy of Evil Dead, quite a bit of grain on it, you know, after I'd owned it for a while. And I kind of preferred the viewing experience of that than watching Evil Dead on Blu-ray. I mean, even though I still love Evil Dead, I don't know if you have a similar experience.
I think I usually I like the Blu-ray, because I remember the first time I saw a Blu-ray, it was of Stanley Kubrick's 2001, and I saw a person in the background in a window that I never saw before. And stuff like that is popping up. So it's sometimes in Blu-ray, when it's really well shot movie, you can find new Blu-ray moment. But of course, some of the films look kind of cheaper when you see them in all its glory. Everything's well lit, and every part of the screen is maybe some of these films can look better when they're dark and you can't see every detail of them. I love that thing of discovering new things in it and kind of seeing, and even some of the films maybe didn't have the right on VHS, especially they were in full frame. And now you can see like a CinemaScope shot, half the picture was gone on the VHS. And suddenly you can see 50% more of the film. So, I mean, I think the ups are... I think there are more ups than downs to me when it comes to this, but I can see your point, but I'm a big time Blu-ray fan as well. So.
Do you still are you just Blu-ray now, or do you know given the content of the film, do you still have some VHSs, or you got
completely? Yeah, I still have VHSs and laser discs and DVDs, and I have all formats, so I can't. But I have sold a lot of my VHS, but I kept maybe 50 or something like that. So I can, and I never would get rid of my VHS player. So I need to have that, but. I rarely buy a new VHS tape. That almost can't happen if I didn't come upon something that was really nostalgic or collector's gem. You know.
Yeah, I have to say, yeah, I don't really have any VHS tapes.
No. Did you ever have it, or was it before your?
No, because I think DVD was 99 or 2000, and I got my first like DVDs in the early 2000s. So yeah, I had VHS when I was a kid. I'm 33 now. I remember right up until my teens having VHSs. I think I got my first DVD when I was like 17 or something. So yes, I am old enough to remember that. some interesting details on my backstory for the listeners there. going back to your movie though, let's talk about how you got the cast together. You got a very good cast, and certainly in the central roles, Stefan and Lena are very good in both their roles. How did they come onto the project? Are they the people that you kind of envisioned for the roles?
Actually, I had in way back when I started on the old script, I had another guy called Sven Walter, and he's also in the film. He's the neighbor that Simone, the character, runs to hide her wine. Mm-hmm. So he's in it in a small part, and that feels good because he was thought of he was the original cat, but now he's much too old. But Stefan, Stefan had been away from movies for a few years, and I had kind of forgotten about him. But then I met him on LinkedIn, actually, you know, that social media thing.
Or, for getting jobs and stuff. And
exactly. Really strange. And we started chatting there, and he had seen some of my short films and really liked them. From there, I started the idea grow in my mind that maybe he should do this, or let's see if he likes this character. Because then I was rewriting the script, and I sent him a draft of the old script just to get to know the character, and he liked it. And we had a meeting, and we decided right there and then that let's do this one. And he was on board straight away with making it low budget and sacrificing a bit of his salary and stuff, you know, to really make this see the light of day. From there, so I had Stefan and I had a cinematographer who also was on board. And from there, we started looking around to see what people can we attached to this project. And Stefan had made a casting with Lena for another film that didn't go off. Mm. And he remembered her and said that you should really see this girl because she's really good and we have chemistry when acting. So I had Lena and another girl as like the first. I was doing the casting myself, and so I met Lena and Stefan on a hotel room in Stockholm where they live. I live in Gothenburg, and felt fabulous straight away. So the other one I had in mind went out the window after seeing Lena, and so pretty quickly I had the two leads, and from there Lena was she was big time actress in the 80s, actually. So she have a lot in common with the character she is playing, because she also been away from movies for many years now, doing mostly theater and other things. The thing of being in the spotlight and coming away from it that was something that she had dealt with quite a lot.
So she could kind of relate to the character.
Right, exactly. So that was good. Then a lot of the other actors were on board. They liked the script. Let's say quite a few really liked the script, and they didn't have so many days on set, so they let's do this. They were really nice about it, and since Stefan and Lena was aboard, and then we had other good names in Sweden, actors, so that also helps to get someone else to read it, you know, and to he or she is in it, then maybe I should be as well, you know. Kind of was like a chain snowball effect.
Once you got the ball rolling.
Exactly. So that was pretty smooth, I have to say. I never had to hunt someone down too much and you know, keep stalking them. And the ones that didn't want to be in the film, they just went on. But mostly, I got the people that I wanted. The casting was really smooth. The toughest thing with the film was the post-production, because by then the money was... we had no more money, and we had to search for finance. And that was a tough part to kind of, you know, wait with an edited movie just to go into the sound editing and all those things that was really... So
you feel like the shoot itself went pretty smoothly? Because I was going to ask you, because I've asked this to a few people, and I've got different answers of what was the kind of difference between going from making short films to making a feature film, Was there more difficulty to that? And there seems to be some people seem to find the transition very easy. Others, it's more complicated.
Yeah, I think time-wise, the last short I did before Video Man, I felt after when I finished that one, I felt I could just as well have made a feature, because it took me so much time to finish it. But on the other hand, I was making commercials by the side all the time, so it was a time limit for me. On Video Man, I had month that I could only focus on this film, and that was different, of course. But still, it felt like if you're making a short, it can take you a lot of time to get it the way you want it anyway. And I think that for me, that made me see that I should not make another short, because it can only take you, if you have a great success, but I mean, so many people are making shorts today, I think, mm-hmm. and it's really tough to stick out or to, you know, get somewhere career-wise on making shorts. Of course, until you feel that now I know what I'm doing with my craft, and when you get to that point, I felt that the feature is I couldn't motivate myself to make another short, because it took me like 1.5 years making the last one, finishing it up. So I was so settled and my mind was so set on making a feature. And also, since I've been writing a lot of features, and frustrated and not be able to let characters develop the way they do in features, I was so ready for it, you know. So to me, I never had any doubt in my mind that I shouldn't do this.
It was going to be a feature.
Yeah. So I think that that helped me a lot, of course. But then it's frustrating when you're low budget, of course, and you have to wait. Because we had like 2 weeks that we shot straight, and then we had another two weeks that was like took us month to get through because of schedules of actors and all the people helping out, you know. So that can be frustrating on a feature, of course, seeing the light in the end of the tunnel. Because usually when you make a short, you have like a few days and it's over with. And it's all the post-production that is the toughest, or the pre-production. But here, of course, when you have everything in the can, it feels amazing, because it's a feature. But still, I would say the post-production is the toughest part for me.
So you mean post-production just in terms of getting the kind of final money? It wasn't right. In terms of editing or anything like that?
No, it was rather the money side of it, yeah. Because we didn't have full finance going into this, so we knew that this was going to be the case, that we will have to show financiers first draft edited together and then get more money. But still, it's scary when you don't know for sure that the money is gonna come in.
You must be very pleased then of the. You know, the finished product is out there, and
yeah.
I certainly know it got a very good reaction at Fright Fest, from keeping tabs on Fright Fest through the New Horror Express. Right. Social media seemed to get a good reaction, both from audiences and critics. It must have been very pleased. Right.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think the reaction from after the Fright Fest screening was really good. And we got some great reviews. And that's amazing, of course, and fun. It, in a way, feels like the UK audience is liking it better than the Swedish one. And maybe that's not a surprise, since I'm not that into Swedish films either. I feel more at home with the UK film or American independent movies than the Swedish movie scene these days. But
That's I mean, obviously you mentioned that Ben Wheatley and Alec Lowe and Mike Leigh. So I obviously seem to have an appreciation for UK cinema. I'm talking about UK things. I have to say, one of the most surprising and random moments in the film is when Samantha Fox turns up. she was like a known tabloid figure in the 80s here, but I didn't think anybody else, you know, like...
Yeah. She was actually amazingly big in Sweden and Norway and the Nordic countries, actually, yeah.
Wow.
We had a magazine called OK, that was like the for music and movies, you know, kind of a tabloid thing for youngsters. And she was in every, what do you say, episode or no?
issue,
right, on that one. And she was in some TV shows, like guest starring. And so I kind of grew up with her. Also, for a couple of years, like Samantha Fox was she was really big in Sweden. that was a funny story because I knew all the time that I wanted to have 80s, a soundtrack reflecting the 80s in that way that I wanted both like pop songs and also a score, instrumental score. And I mean, in the 80s, at least in Sweden, we had movie soundtracks like on the top 10 most selling albums. And even if I liked that thing, that was a separate thing, that you could go buy a soundtrack to a film, and that was like a real, you know, something of its own. So that was also a nostalgic thing that I wanted to bring to this film. And we have a soundtrack out on Lakeshore Records. Maybe you know that one. So that was fantastic when we got them to sign onto this. But before that, we knew also that we wanted some Italian disco tunes in the film, since there's a connection between Italy and obviously, and the main character, he has Italian roots. And then the 80s thing with the other character who loves the 80s, everything about the 80s and music. So that's their connection, the Italian disco. So we have a great composer called Johan Agerbjörn that is Swedish, and he made three Italian disco songs. And on two of them, we got singers from the 80s, male singers in that scene, like Ryan Paris, who made a song called La Dolce Vita. It was really a big hit over here. So he's singing on one of these songs. And we had the third song, we were looking for a female singer too. And when he played me that song, I said that this should either be sung by Samantha Fox or Kylie Minogue, because it kind of had that Stock Aitken Waterman vibe to it. And it was called Hot Boy. So it's a really cheesy, funny, nice song. He got in contact with Samantha somehow, because I was just joking around. But he got in contact with her manager, and a month later he said that Samantha is on. She's going to do this. She's going to sing this song. That was a really fun thing. And we also did a video for that one. So she came over to Gothenburg for a couple of days, and we shot a video to her, to this song that sadly is not on a soundtrack because of different legal things, but she has released it as a single. So that's a little bit about Samantha Fox and this film.
Like I say, it was definitely a surprise. were you at all worried that, obviously we've talked about how the film's actually quite unusual, the Argento meets Mike Leigh thing. On the surface, though, because it does have the synthy score and it is all very rooted in the 80s. And there is a lot of movies that have been released in recent years that pay tribute to the 80s. Were you at all worried that people would prejudge this movie as just like, oh, this is just another cash into the 80s?
Yeah. I think that when we started out, it wasn't that many films doing this. There were a few, of course. But when we were ready to release it, like you say, there were quite a few of these films out there. So I don't know if I were worried about that. Maybe I was thinking that this will help us and make people go see it. And then it's not what they expected it was, but probably hopefully they will like it anyway.
There does seem to be a thirst for 80s horror nostalgia. Those have to be
right.
And exactly. So, I mean, you could be right. It could help, but I mean, obviously, people are getting a very different film to what they maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the same with the horror scene. That I think it's more a film about people liking horror than it's a horror film. And so I think if I only can get horror lovers to watch this film, I think they will like it, but maybe not for the reasons that they like horror films, but maybe they can see a bit of themselves in it, or at least there's some kind of mentality of the fan mentality and the collector mentality in it. I think that
I think a lot of people listening to this, me and a lot of people who view it will have a kind of connection there to some of the mentality, maybe not quite to the extremity of that, of the character of Ennio,
of course,
but some of an inkling of that mentality. And I think there is a lot for horror fans to enjoy within the movie as well. Some of the setups and some of the scenes are filmed like horror scenes. For example, when he goes to the character of Ennio goes to another VHS collector's house to see if he's got the missing tape. When he's chased through his flat, that's very much filmed like a scene in a giallo. You know, like a chase sequence, of a victim, or when he flees out the flat and jumps out the window.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. I decided to have fun with that, trying to pay as much homage to the giallo as I could, since that's really something that the main character is into, and it's almost as the film is becoming his own giallo, the further it goes. The films he's been watching is kind of, when he gets in trouble, that's kind of what he sees in his mind, because he's living through his movies, really. So that kind of makes sense for me to make it giallo-esque when this guy is starting to get in trouble.
And it's interesting how it's kind of set up, because you don't know how much of this stuff's kind of happening to the guy, particularly towards the end. You don't know how much of the stuff's kind of happening to the guy, to Ennio, and how much is just part of his kind of fevered imagination.
Right, exactly. I'm a big fan of that. And rewatching films and finding small clues, you know, that can maybe tell you if it's for real or not. So I'd rather not tell too much about that. and that can irritate some people, and some really like that. But I love that about, for instance, David Lynch, that you don't really know the whole. It's kind of up to you as an audience as to make the last puzzle fit.
Kind of puzzle it together yourself.
Yeah, right.
And there is some Lynchian moments in the film. I would say, particularly when he's trapped behind the television dream sequence.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of I mean, so many filmmakers that are inspiring, of course, and I think Roman Polanski is one of my one of the best ones, because I think he also does a bit what I like to do, that he in his best work. My favorite Polanski is The Tenant, and I think that is a character study of the main character, and it's really funny. It got lots of black humor in it, and it's also scary and psychologically mesmerizing. He has all those different layers in it that I want to, you know. So that is a real, that's always one of my biggest inspirations, that film. I think, like you said, there are coming a lot of stuff like that lately in the horror genre, that there are bending the genre walls and then putting new stuff into these films, and that I really like. Absolutely. I think Polanski was really early doing that.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think it's often overlooked. I think sometimes when people discuss Hereditary or one of the more recent examples, they kind of overlook that it's not nobody's reinventing the wheel. It's these kind of non-horror characters in horror films, it has been done, and the films Polanski was making, like The Tenant, Repulsion, Rosemary's Baby, they're all fantastic films, but also have like proper characters that are not just kind of stereotypical cardboard horror characters.
No, definitely not. That's true. He was doing it in the late 60s, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's an important person in this genre, I think.
Yeah. And it's just certainly underappreciated. There is a lot of films out there that have had kind of more rounded characters. I think critics often overlook that. And you talked about Don't Look Now, and that's another great example of that.
Right. And I think also, of course, David Cronenberg, he's been making a lot of great films, especially in the 80s, I think, where a film for like The Fly, for instance, can be seen as a splatterfest or like a really horror film, but it also has one of the most beautiful love stories, I think, in it. It's so tragic in the core, that film. And also a thing that... for instance, his Dead Ringers. I mean, it's more like a psychological drama, I think, but still he has his horror shell on it. I think many horror lovers like that film, but it's a really fabulous character piece, really. The same thing with Dead Zone, or many things he did in the 80s, I think it goes both ways. He's a fantastic director. I mean, he's so many great things. Videodrome,
there's so many great things. I know, like it's great that he's again, it gets the due he's deserved. I think, you know, when you make horror films, or you make films that are within the horror realm, sometimes it takes a while for people to kind of catch up, and suddenly became like a kind of prestige director post like History of Violence, but he's been making great films since the 70s.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great film, History of Violence, but for me, I was disappointed at the first watch, since I wanted a Cronenberg film, more like the way he used to do it. But he keeps on developing, I think, and doing different stuff all the time, that without losing his roots, really. But I think that was a kind of a big jump for him.
Definitely a departure from his a lot of his previous films.
Right.
Maybe he just thought he'd kind of come to the end of body horror and his.
Yeah,
that kind of realm that he worked in for a long time.
Right. Yeah, he's done a lot of pictures.
Yeah, Yeah, and it's remarkable because he's been going for a long time, and not all of his pictures are great, but there's a lot of good ones considering how many he's made.
Right. Yeah, I think that's really fascinating that recently, I think he's always interesting. He's never stagnating like a few other great directors. They're kind of doing their best work in the beginning and the middle of their careers, and then they're kind of zoning out and making more mainstream or kind of not that. It feels like their hunger is settling, but Cronenberg feels like he's always in the front of making films. He's like testing the medium and continuously being interested in making good films and
evolving,
new films.
Evolving his art form.
Yeah, evolving, right. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. and that's rare, I think. Yeah, and that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And like you say, it is rare, you know, quite a lot of directors have their kind of great period or best period earlier on, and don't make excellent films kind of throughout. I was going to go back to your film.
Yeah.
One of the other things I was going to say, did you talk to Stefan a lot about the character of Ennio? Because I feel like the character treads a very fine line of like, I think he falls to be, in the end, still quite likable. And but he can be an asshole. But you still support him. You're still rooting for him. I feel as a viewer, you still root for him, even at the end of the film. And were you kind of very conscious of that, or are these kind of this characters, you know, because you could be like, it could fall over into being completely unlikable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because that was a dialogue between me and Stefan all the time. And Stefan was he was on the good guy side, and I was on the bad guy side. he was really concerned that he stayed likable, and that went on even in the editing. When he saw the first cut of the film, he said, "He's not likable. You got to have this scene over here instead of there, because you got to make him likable, goddammit." I'm not, since I myself love films that are, to take an example, I love American Psycho. And I think I don't like that film because of him being likable. I don't think anyone can say that Christian Bale in that film is likable. But he's so damn interesting, and it's a fascinating film to see. So it's a masterpiece, I think. So I don't think a film need to have a likable character, but of course it helps, and a lot of films need that. And maybe Video Man is a film that would need it. I don't know. I don't know what makes that, why a film works without having a likable character or not. But that was something we were talking about a lot. And I listened to Stefan a bit, and probably if he wouldn't have fought me, maybe you wouldn't like him. I don't know. Maybe I had made him more of an asshole. So I'm really glad he did that, actually, because a lot of people has been saying that what you're just saying, that he's walking a thin line. And maybe this film needs this, that he's winning in the end as a more likable than not. Yeah. I don't know, but that was
I'm not sure in terms of I totally agree that I think sometimes people can get hung up on likable characters, and that's, you know, there's plenty of films that have totally unlikable characters that, because they're charismatic or they're just interesting, that you follow them. I suppose in your story, like when a character's under threat or under a perceived threat, there's maybe an element of needing to root for them a little bit, even if you like them throughout the whole film.
Right.
That's just my guess. I don't know. That's why.
I think that's always going to be a thing that I will have to struggle with. How much do you need to think about that? That is a real interesting thing to research, I think, in filmmaking. It's an interesting subject.
I suppose Lena's character is kind of the same, even though she's more naturally sympathetic. There is that kind of part of where there's parts where she's not entirely likable either, but yeah, you do kind of root for, well, I felt as an audience member, I root for both characters, and Lena gives a great performance as well, and I believe she won an award in Sweden, in the kind of Swedish version of the Academy Awards, the Guldbaggen, exactly. Is that the name?
Yeah, that's exactly Guldbaggen, right. It's the best prize you can get as an actor or filmmaker here in Sweden, is the Guldbaggen. So she won for her performance, and that was great, of course. I'm so glad for her, because since also then she hasn't been doing that many films for many years, and this was like the greatest comeback she could get. So that was great.
That's awesome. So What are you planning next? What's your going to be your follow-up on Video Man? I heard you say somewhere that you were thinking about an English-speaking project.
Right. Yeah, that's a dream, of course, that the next one would be in English and made with a English-based or UK-based production company in collaboration with a Swedish one. I think that would be that's what I'm aiming for at the moment, but nothing is settled or clear in any way. I'm still writing the script, but that's what I'm aiming for with this one. I have two different scripts I'm writing at the moment, but the one
can you tell us anything about them? Are they also horror pictures?
One of them is definitely a horror picture, and the one that I'm hoping to do next as an English speaking film. And that one is a psychological horror film, I would say. But again, when the characters are really, I hope, well developed, and it's a lot about human psyche. But this is more of a straightforward horror piece, I would say. Definitely psychological horror.
And is that the English speaking one, or is it the
Yeah, it is. It's tough to. I don't know how much I
I want to. You don't have to give anything away that you don't want to give away. It's fine. It won't bully you.
But it's. I think it's funny because a few people I know that they love to speak about what they're writing at the present time, and I can sometimes feel that if I start talking about it before I have it all on paper, it kind of goes away for me. I kind of drains the blood of it in some strange way. All the tension of writing it, the kind of goes away. Do you know what I mean? Have you heard that before? Or
Yeah. I mean, like, obviously. Yes, different people have different writing processes, and I know that some people very much like to keep it under wraps until there's a finished script there that can be presented to people. So that's fine.
Yeah. But I say that much, that it's about a man that's kind of desperate to redeem himself, so he's kind of looking for a situation where he can mend himself psychologically. and he finds a potential situation like this, and then it becomes a crazy ride for him. But it's the working name is Romantic Horror. That's the thing.
Okay.
That's the name of it at this present time.
Okay. Well, we wish you all the best and getting that and trying to get that project off the ground and other project as well. And I very much enjoyed Video Man. It's like I say, it seems to be doing very well from what I've seen. And thank you very much for coming on the show today, Christian.
Yeah, thank you very much, Scott. It's been a pleasure talking to you. So nice.
That was my guest, Christian, there, who I'd like to thank once again for being on the show. And if you'd like to check out Video Man yourself, you can, as it's now available on Blu-ray and DVD through the Fright Fest Presents label. That's all for this time. All that's left for me to say now is remember you can rate, review and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher, and also check us out wherever good podcasts are available. Plus, you can follow us on Twitter, give us a like on Facebook, and finally, remember to tune in next time where I'll be chatting to David H. Thornton, aka Art the Clown. Until then, see ya!